Take us away, Will.
Emos deregenia fane rhododactylos eos, and the rose-fingered dawn stretches out once more. This quote was very prevalent, and I think it's a good constant throughout this hero's journey. What did you folks reading this story think about your own hero's journey when comparing it to Odysseus?
Well, like we were talking about before we recorded, it's hard to kind of put ourselves in the shoes of an ancient Greek son of God off on a journey through sirens and demigods and traveling through hell and all of this. But as we go through Homer's Odyssey, it really adds into perspective, like what we can do to make a difference when you see Odysseus in the face of all of these monsters. He always has a plan. He always has something to fall back on, whether it's just his own wits or his own strength. He's going to figure out a way to get past it. I think that can be inspiring for anybody reading this story to just say, yeah, there's a way forward. There's a hero's journey out there for me. I just don't know what it is, but I know that there is a way I can act. And I think that's pretty important for all of us today.
Yeah, I mean, it sure makes butchering Greek on the internet a heck of a lot easier when I know what Odysseus went through.
It certainly gives us a job to work on.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I think.
it's really right after reading this, it just reminded me of the hero's journey as a whole. Just going through what Odysseus is going through and the temptations that he faces and the amount of time he spends on those islands and angering the gods above and everything. This is kind of similar to what many, I would specifically say, young men have to go through throughout their life. And just trying to find their road to travel on while at the same time trying to discover their own weaknesses and overcoming them.
Like we see a lot of legends of just like coming of age stories, kind of like these kings giving their children up to live a weekend off in the wilderness or something like that. And it's like you kind of need those trials in life to bring out the person that you're supposed to be, 'cause otherwise you're just living life as a child.
Yeah, and also another thing can be just remembering who you are and what you're supposed to be doing. And that kind of leads to another example that I thought of while reading this book, which is about the young prince in Egypt who is tasked of finding a pearl and bringing it back to his community. But along the way, he drinks from a cup from these settlers. He falls into a deep sleep, and then he wakes up completely forgetting who he was or about the pearl, and he just wanders around for a long time until all of a sudden something clicks and then he goes after it. So with Odysseus, his task is just to go back home to his wife and child, only to realize that with many of these temptations around, it's kind of a zigzaggy kind of, what would you call it?
Journey.
Zigzaggy kind of journey to just,
Perhaps an odyssey?
yeah.
Perhaps a
Yeah.
misadventure?
Misadventure.
Peradventure?
To actually go through, yeah.
So for me, like, I think what's interesting about Odysseus and why I couldn't possibly compare myself to him is because before the story started, he's already the hero. He's already been battle tested. He's already succeeded, and he's already built his kingdom and had to leave it and had to be convinced by Agamemnon to leave it and go and be this great tactician. And then, due to all sorts of twists and turns. You know, it takes him 20 years to return from start of war to end of journey. But Telemachus, Telemachos, how do you guys want to pronounce that?
In my head, it was Telemachus.
Telemachus.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the lesson of translations. So,
We all have a
Telly,
different word in our head.
Odysseus's son, goes on a journey of, it's almost a diplomatic journey, looking for hope and news of his father. And that was more relatable to me because this is a kid who was born
Right.
into privilege. He didn't have his father. A part of him was missing. There was a void that he needed to fill. And it was an interesting journey to go on with him because it was much safer than that of Odysseus. And it was a big juxtaposition because he's going and asking advice and he's being welcomed in and they're throwing a feast in his honor and they're having competitions and games and dancing and singing. And then they're giving him gifts and respecting him and appreciating him in a way that we don't do today, that's for sure. And I would love to do that with my friends. Could you imagine being able to just throw a competition and a feast and a dance party every time someone came visiting and have them stay for a week? What a lifestyle.
Yeah, but at the same time, that's like the upper class. That's only like the kings and the king's family that get that kind of lifestyle. If it's like the serfs and the poor people like us, we're just, looking after the sheep and the pigs all day and crying that Odysseus has been gone for 20 years.
It's more of a
And
dis
we.
it's more of a temptation in a way.
It's certainly a privilege. I don't think it could even be called a temptation because of the societal expectations of the time, right? But I think that even the way we see the servants interacting with Odysseus as a beggar, we see how benevolent and kind and amazing this leader was. And of course, that's all been colored. But it's interesting nonetheless to see this character respected so much and loved by all the peoples. And yeah, I couldn't relate to Odysseus, but Telemachus, Telemachus, however you want to call it, that was interesting to see this young man with, in his opinion, no ability to defend himself or protect his land, going out to find his father and bring him home and reclaim what was rightfully theirs. That was cool.
Yeah, he also, like, it tells that he also encourages his mother to pick one of the suitors that wants to go after his father's marriage bed or whatever. So, like, you can see that he's conflicted too. Like, deep down, he feels that he knows Odysseus is dead, but at the same time, he is ever hopeful that he's gonna come back to the point where he's gonna ship off to Sparta just to ask anybody and everybody, have you seen him? Do you know where he is? Is he dead or not? Like, I just want answers.
And
The uncertainty is killing us all.
willed on by the gods, and that's something that we still have today. You know, people have that divine inspiration to pursue something that seems hopeless, and people call them crazy. And you know, the ones that succeed are heroes still. I think one of the most interesting parts was Odysseus in Book 9 when he was at, I don't know how to pronounce any of these names, guys. The Phaeacians?
Okay.
How do
Yeah, I
you
think it's.
pronounce it?
I'm not sure.
All
It's
right, so he's
different
at
every
this
time.
island and he shows up, and in his natural way, he doesn't give his name and he hides his identity and he hides his upset under his cloak. But then finally they ask him for his story and he recounts all of these tales, and they're epic, right? Like, they're literally epic. This guy has gone through just the most crazy trials and is still going through them, still enduring, has lost all of his companions to sea, and has been forced to commit himself to a bed of a goddess for 9 years in a cave with all the luxuries of the world. But still he breaks away from that to return to family and love and home, and that sort of love is higher even than the one that he could foster for the goddess, and that's pretty powerful stuff.
See,
Yeah.
this is where I started my whole theory about like the sexuality and like the femininity in the Odyssey, because like in the Bible you would never see something like this. And this is like, for all we know, a little bit older than some of the oldest texts of the Bible, if not around the same time. We know it's before the collapse of the Bronze Age, so it might line up with some Old Testament business. But like, it prizes like monogamy and sticking to one love partner as a virtue. Like, it presents that as something that you should strive for. Whether or not this was written by a woman, you could say that it presents a whole different idea than some of the other ancient texts have. Because, like, Odysseus never wants to become a sexual, partner to any of these otherworldly gods. He wants to stick with the one that, he's in love with. And that sounds a lot more like a female fantasy today than a male fantasy of 6,000 years ago. So I don't know if I'm articulating that well enough, but those are just the things that pop into my head.
Well, in a way, it reminds me of what Jordan Peterson says about finding a partner, a romantic one, especially when you're a higher status, and that is just to pick one, never go after multiple. And when you pick one, you are essentially giving yourself to that person only, and putting all the commitment into it. So Odysseus is with Penelope because, he chose her, essentially, nobody else.
Yeah, but what I'm wondering is that, Jordan Peterson has that opinion because of thousands and thousands of years of evolution of the human psyche and culture that, we're conditioned to prize monogamy, wherein, some of the similar texts from around the same time, you don't see that at all. Solomon has 1,000 wives, 300 wives and 700 concubines. We do not have the same virtue there that we do here.
Well, even Odysseus is getting the prized women from all of these places that he's raiding, right? Like he keeps losing them in the ocean. But the idea of sacking a town and taking the pretty women is not a new notion at this time, circa 3,000 years ago, just to slightly correct you, Scott.
Well, that's when we think it was written, not when the story was actually fabricated, not when we actually started influencing our culture with the Odyssey and the Iliad and the work of Homer and the work of the Bible started to mesh together. It all becomes a little vague.
That's a good point. I do like the idea that Pat makes, though, of the journey to all these different islands being relatable to men our age. If you do away with all of the details and then just say at each station, these are the different failings of the psyche, like addiction and temptation and wantonness,
Yeah,
right? Because
desire.
these are on our path. All of these temptations, all of these sins.
And also, in a way, it's also part of the shadow, too. When Odysseus is known as a man of twists and turns, and he is able to disguise himself and hide himself. And there's a part of the book where he is covered up and he acts like a slave. And then he meets one of the gods, I think, or somebody else, and he's as given the name Nobody, and I think he mentions the tales that he's been on and everything, and just sneaking past through. But also, that is sort of like hiding your true self in order to get past the odds. Of getting back home. Essentially, like mirroring your foes with what they have, if that makes sense.
Ever the clever tactician. Yeah, that nobody tale with the Cyclops, son of Poseidon, in his cave was ridiculous. ridiculous. I don't know how your translation happened, Scott, but it seemed so simple and in such a plain English language that it couldn't possibly have been the truth in Greek, but it was funny nonetheless.
Yeah, it went kind of quick in my version. Like all of the really weird tales, like the sirens was like 2 pages. It's like, oh yeah, then there were sirens, and then I was strapped to a pole and we had to sail past, and then the Cyclops, and he threw a ship, he threw a rock at our ship, and then he took off the top of a mountain and he threw that at our ship.
There is this big part of me that just kind of thinks that if this was real, it's just this giant hyperbolic exaggeration and fabrication of this very slutty man's trip around the world for 10 years after the war, just sleeping with random people. Like, oh, yeah, I was a goddess. Yeah, I was there 9 years under her thumb. I had no control. I'm so sorry, Penelope. And it's like, you lying whore. It's like, if we assume that I've never seen gods and gods don't exist, you cheated.
There's another reason why it might be written by a woman, because it couldn't have been written by Odysseus, because these tales are just way too outlandish. This was written by one of the women who wanted to make Odysseus look like the great king that he was. Like, yeah, sure, he was sleeping around, but he was being raped by these gods and goddesses and whatever.
This man who could kill you with a punch was being overpowered by the gods.
Yeah, well, everybody can be overpowered by the gods.
Except for when Odysseus is strong enough to not be overpowered by the gods and it plays out to the story.
Yeah, or like Achilles or Heracles or any of the other mythic heroes.
Any other instance where it doesn't make sense for man to be overpowered by immortals?
Yeah, but I kind of picture it as like Odysseus coming home from war, telling all of his journeys, and then a woman saying, "Oh, that's remarkable. Let me write that down real quick. Everyone will love this at home." And
Oh,
then there were
that's
giants,
remarkable.
cyclopses.
Yeah, it's really strange.
But I do like, as I've said for a while now, the blessings and the omens and reading the signs and all of these things that they have intertwined to give them optimism and hope. And that's one of the prevalent themes that I think really stuck out to me was just how often he's like, yo, crew, like, we need to get home. Stop getting drunk. This is like our homeland, our fatherland. We need to go back. This is it pales in comparison. Heck, even when they're doing the competitions, at one point they're like, how fun is the discus toss when it is the hour to eat food? And they're like, oh yeah, true. And they throw down their tools and they go and they eat food because it's the appropriate time to feast. And how could anything be better than eating when it is the appropriate time to eat? And the ritual that they have, like it's almost non-negotiable, and it makes life require less thinking for them.
Yeah, like the tradition and like that like liturgy almost that you see in Christianity or in the Bible in general. It's like, yeah, you do need these little segments of order to keep all the chaos in line. Like to have an hour set aside in the day, like that's when you eat. That's a useful psychotechnology. Then you know what you're supposed to be doing at that point in time. And like a lot of people these days, like, always talk about like reading the signs of the birds, and they call it irrational. But like I mentioned this in our last Bible video, that that's not irrational at all, in the same way that they put lightning rods on their churches because they think God is attacking their churches. It's completely rational to say, when the birds do this thing in the sky, bad stuff happens. So be mindful of what the birds are doing, because, if they're headed south, it might get cold. If they're headed north, might get a nice warm south wind coming our way. Like these things don't just come down to, oh, well, science nowadays says that's not true, that's irrational, when when the data they had at the time suggests, yes, this is completely consistent with my beliefs and how I see the world. So it's really interesting to just put yourself in those footsteps to see that perspective of how they are able to actually see the future. That's pretty cool.
One, even like seeing Dawn as a goddess who chooses to greet you each morning, that at any point she could just say, no, I'm not going to start the day. I'm going to go westward and hide out because I've given up on man. And that each time they see her fingers spreading across the sky, they're greeted by divine intention and they get up. And it's like, I woke up at 5 this morning, and for the first time in my life, I thought to myself, oh, what a blessing to be awake. And that's because I read for 14 hours yesterday, The Odyssey.
Now I finally get to talk about it with the lads.
But it's just the way we perceive the world, I feel like, especially in the West, we take so much for granted. Like, especially as men, I think we're very hard on ourselves when it comes to like self-care and gratitude and victories. Like, how many of us do everything that we think we need to do in a day and get to bed at the end of the day feeling we haven't done anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like we get our standard and we meet it and we consider it nothing.
Yeah.
And these people just had the perspective that Rosy Finger Dawn could just stop whenever she wanted to. So, like, that element of trust and belief had to be present in their life or they would fall apart. It's not that they have a choice whether or not to believe in Rosy Fingered God or Rosy Fingered Dawn or these gods and goddesses. Like, they have to put their trust in all of these powers.
And I would say because we haven't, and that we don't, that's why we are so fallen apart and in pieces.
We have to consider
that's why we have the meaning crisis.
We have to consider the fact that just because the glass is empty doesn't mean that there's not going to be any water to fill it the next day or next week or next month. We just know that at any point in time we can think that, yes, we can take the glass and fill it up with water and be grateful for it. But we don't think of it that way.
And we take it for granted that it's filled with air.
Yeah. And even if we think that, even if we have the glass full of water, sometimes it's never going to be enough. And that's how often we think about it, things nowadays. We just have to be able to appreciate and accept the fact that we have enough. And when we get enough, that's good enough.
It's interesting. And I think, you know, sacrificing meat to gods is a very easy way at an unconscious level to indoctrinate a culture to be grateful. Like, if you are sacrificing to gods every time you see a friend, you're like, oh, my friend's here, let's sacrifice a cow thigh. Like, you're gonna always be grateful. You're gonna be constantly looking for reasons to be grateful. Every time you go out on a quest, you have to do this big wine spilling and sacrifice to the gods to make sure that they're appeased for your journey. Like, you're programming your brain at an unconscious level to look for excuses to embolden yourself and be grateful and have luck on your side and have ambition and aspiration and hope. I'm not saying we should go back to meat-based sacrifices, but there's no reason that we couldn't, I don't know, burn some sage. You say a little prayer before you leave in the morning. Accept the fact that there is fatality in this world and love your loved ones before you leave.
Yeah, I always think of the complete contrast between how people these days view like ancient animal sacrifice and how people view, you know, just recent like Native American history where they prided themselves on using every part of the animal and they were thankful to all of these spirits or gods, however they articulate the spiritual powers. But like, how How is it that we look at these ancient cultures sacrificing animals like so much differently than recent Native American cultures that we prize so dearly? Like these guys had it right, but the ancient guys over here, they were doing something barbaric. When you really compare the two, they were just doing the same thing. They were giving thanks for this animal that the gods or the spirits have were kind enough to bestow upon this little tribe to be lucky enough to eat dinner for a night.
I think you're blessed with a good opinion and perspective and insight to the native peoples that is not shared among North Americans. And if you were to ask my father, he would tell you we have spent a very meticulous amount of years curating a curriculum that shows us the native cultures as barbarians in loincloth gathered around a fire pit outside of a teepee, and not the true culture of their times that was as intelligent as it was and had built cities of palisades, and that we've
Yeah.
been dumbing down this perspective and ignoring the cultures and the peoples that we committed genocide against to found these nations.
Yeah, something happened there down the line. That's a generational gap. There was a year where they were just, what are we teaching these kids? Like you watch like Disney's Pocahontas and it's like, "What are you singing?" Okay, that's a little sketchy.
Well, it's like these are the people that literally guarded the entire nation and held back the French and the English for 100 years. They couldn't get into the St. Lawrence, and they had to teach them how to prevent scurvy because the Europeans had no idea what the heck they were doing. They gave them the pelts to stay warm. They taught them about the region. Like these people have not been given the credit that is due to them. While at the same time, we have sort of acknowledged it. And it's just this bastardization to pretend that they were running around in loincloths on tiny little birch bark canoes when they were cultivating the entire region and fishing, and they had massive fishing weirs and grain and trade routes. And so that's a whole other bag.
Yeah, maybe that's not the best topic to get into these days, but it was a parallel that I thought was worth drawing.
It's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, these things usually are when you're dealing with things this old.
Yeah, it's something I'd love to have a conversation about, but like all of these ancient texts, the minute I open my mouth, I feel like I'm ignorant and arrogant, and that people don't want to give me the time of day to let me make my blunders in conversation because there's just so many blind spots as a result of the lack of education. Like, these past 2 years reading these books, I wouldn't have imagined to have read what we've read in the past 2 years at any other point in my life. And I'm so thankful for it, but it just opens up my eyes to how much I know I don't know.
Yeah, and I feel like we're caught between two different parts of the population. Like those who have zero knowledge of ancient literature and those who are experts and study it every day and teach it for a living. Like where's
Yeah.
the middle ground there? Like I'm trying to find my people and it's just
It's
either
a
I'm
small
finding,
amount.
yeah,
It's a
I'm
very small amount.
finding either
Well, it's like,
teachers and mentors or people who don't know the first thing of what I'm talking about when I say Athene instead of Athena, or Zeus and Jove being the same character. It's just like, yeah, I don't know where to start here, is what I'm saying.
it's
It's
like I imagine
especially, there's
especially
two
drawing
camps.
different parallels,
I
though.
want to win. There's two camps. There's the siloed, niched off people who know everything about that one book that you're reading, and they're going to tell you why you're wrong. And then there's like the mass
Right.
of people that respect and believe the thing that we've read, but haven't read it themselves and don't even want you to have a conversation about it. And they're just saying, like, it's not your place. You don't respect it. You don't value it. You don't follow it. And you don't know enough about it to talk about it. But that they also don't want to know enough to educate me and have that conversation. And maybe that's just my own imaginings, but it seems bizarre that we couldn't just teach everything to everyone.
Yeah. Like,
Yeah,
just thinking
that's
about how many people you know what the Odyssey is, and how many people have read the Odyssey. Those numbers are the opposite. Okay, go
yeah.
ahead, Pat.
I was going to say that even finding ways to draw parallels to other sorts of medium, like for example, I'm not really into the whole like Greek mythology and all the gods and everything like that. I mean, casually, I find it kind of interesting, but not really. Until I started drawing parallels to the anime Danmachi, where they have characters named after these gods, like Artemis or Hermes. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. I remember reading this in the Odyssey. Let me go back and discover this, and that's what I did. And it's you get a sense of curiosity to know more about that, and it's a good thing, even if you're just going into it blindly, and or if you have very little experience, Benji, you want to know more about it. And just having multiple mediums like that and having different connections and different forms of storytelling, that's very fascinating.
Yeah, I do like that. Like you get into an anime and it's like they've decided that they're going to make a Greek mythological anime that's inspired by these actors in these arenas. And what they do is they name a bunch of characters and they name a bunch of places, and they don't really take away from any of the history or the origin of these names and places and experiences, but they give you a hint of it. And then you can discover, maybe next week or 10 years from now that they didn't invent any of it, and it was all written long before. And there's thousands of backstories that you can read and different sort of deviations of these same characters. And you get to immerse yourself in the cultures and landscapes that you like just as much as the samurai or some other third example.
Yeah, and it works the same way in the opposite direction. Like, I think it was the first episode of the second season of The Mandalorian. And I was watching it with my homies, right? And by the end of it, I was like, that was amazing. It was Beowulf, but it was amazing. And I was the only person that saw that like link. It's like, oh, I mean, I guess. I'm like, what do you mean you guessed? That was Beowulf. We just watched Beowulf. Like, he wasn't a king, but you take the enough pieces from the same ship. He rewrote Beowulf into that episode, and it was awesome. I loved every second of it. But, like these ancient stories do pop up in our culture today, and it's really fun seeing, like, oh, I've read this story before.
And it goes to show how these stories last for a long time.
Well, were there another major theme that you wanted to focus on?
There was one little bit, I think, in book 12. Zeus was referred to just in passing as the All-Father, and it made me think of a lot of the prose Edda and the origins of the Norse mythology, because one of the most famous names for Odin is the All-Father, because he gave birth to all of the Aesir. And in the beginning of the prose Edda, he starts off like as a Christian convert telling the history of Norse mythology. And he starts off with, like, in the beginning it was Adam and Eve and the Genesis story. But, 1,000 years goes by, people forget there was a city called Troy. Troy fell. Everyone who survived the battle went north and settled in, like, the Germanic areas, the Icelandic areas, all along the way. Some of them dropped off, some of them kept going, and that formed all of the origins of the Germanic and Norse religions. And some of the other stuff you see in, like, Eastern European, like Rod Naveri and Asatru, are different religions, but it would make sense to say that they both come from something previous to that. And yeah, I think it was really interesting how, Snorri Sturluson, the guy who gave us the prose Edda, the Younger Edda, like pretty much all we have of the Norse mythological stories, claiming that everything comes from the Battle of Troy and the ones who we don't really get to see afterwards. So I wonder if there's any truth to that, if like these ancient warriors from Troy just ended up migrating north and took their culture with them, and that's how all of these other religions started to form in the Norse regions in Germania. So
Certainly
what
interesting to ponder. Yeah, I don't know much about it. I'll have to figure that out on my own.
I don't know. I have a hard disconnect where with all these myths, sort of believing that anything about it was real. It's like where does the inspiration come from if not extrapolating from history and events? But I don't know.
Yeah. You could also make the argument that, the Prose Edda was written around the year like 900 to 1000, like in the Common Era after Christ. So he could have just been, reading some of the same ancient texts that we're reading and come to the logical conclusion. Well, if Troy was around Turkey and Troy fell, and there was some survivors of like Hector's family, and they had to skedaddle and run north, that would probably be their best option. You could just see him doing like the mental gymnastics to say, oh, this is obviously, we're descended from the Trojans. That's what it is. That's why we're so great. It all makes sense now. But then again, like they have found evidence for, a big battle going on back in the day, so not just from like other texts, but like archaeological stuff. I'm not sure how much, but there are a lot of historians that say the Battle of Troy actually happened, and just as many saying it didn't. So who am I to say either one of them are right or wrong?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to tell.
But putting all that on the back burner, I do like the concept that they have about death and the shades, and the Assembly of Shades chapter was another one where it's this belief system that, everybody that you kill ends up in the afterworld, and there's nothing to stop someone from just rolling up and being like, "Hey, how'd you die?" So it's like there's no secrets among the dead, and everybody's thinking about you and constantly wondering what is going on. And there's nothing stopping you from just being like, "Hey, so what do you think about this?" And going in and checking on Achilles and him t recounting the tales of his battles and celebrating his life. And it's an interesting belief system that the dead think of you and tell stories about you and hang around and are willing to share what they know with you, that nothing is lost in death.
Yeah, and like that afterlife image looks a lot like the Norse mythological afterlife too, like Hell and Hades, very similar. So it's hard to make the point that they came from different sources, especially when you see like other contrasting stories of what happens when you die. Like in the Old Testament, they just say, well, you sleep with your fathers in Sheol. It's a pit in the ground. There's no actual consciousness that happens after you die. And the Buddhists who say you get reincarnated, it all came from like Homer originally that said, oh yeah, you can hang out with other shades when you're after you're dead.
When
Doesn't.
even Dante's Inferno, right? Like the imagery that they describe it with just reminded me so much.
Yeah. Like, really, Christianity gets all of that stuff from the Greeks, too. So, yeah, I don't know.
I kind of anticipate that, if we ever do invent time machines, we're going to go back in time and we're going to discover that There was like one guy with one idea, and then everybody else for hundreds of years was like, ah, I like what you're doing, but what if there was elephants? And they just kept going, just like mutating the same idea. And then eventually, you know, it gets so far from the origin that now someone's using that as their basis of mutation. And you get these things that all stem from the same one guy with one idea. And he's like, fire sucks. Maybe that's what happens when we die.
And it doesn't take long for an idea to get completely changed to like the opposite of what it was. Again, I'm going to bring up Star Wars, but you look at the original trilogy, you know, 1977 to 2020, that's not a long time. But somehow the sequel trilogy is unrecognizable from the original trilogy. So, you know, take that how you want. That's
There you go.
just my ranting as a Star Wars nerd.
Well, it's a good argument because Star Wars is modeled after the hero's journey. I don't know if there's a hero's journey that is older than the Odyssey. From my understanding, it is one of the seminal hero's journeys that we get.
Well, there's that movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was
That
inspired
did
by the
not
hero.
come out before the Odyssey.
It's a good
Well, that's another
movie.
type of medium, though.
I'm sorry, Pat.
Love it.
Like maybe the Epic of Gilgamesh, what's the time frame on that? Is that even a hero's journey?
Yeah, I guess he's another one of those like kingly characters though, so you know, like the Star Wars hero's journey is all about the underdog, right? But when you look at the Odyssey and the Epic of Gilgamesh, that's like the kings of their land, the king of kings, saying, how do I keep what I have and all of this?
Yeah, I think the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Odyssey, these are some of the oldest heroes' journeys, oldest stories. The notion that these concepts could reach this far into the future, assuming the universe wasn't created last Tuesday.
They give credit to the Sumerians for like inventing writing, so that's pro the Epic of Gilgamesh is probably a bit older, then again, just spoken word, the tradition of the oral tradition of keeping these legends alive. It's hard to say which of the stories originates earlier.
You gotta assume at a certain point in history, there just wasn't enough time in a man's life to tell a hero's journey because he was getting mauled by saber-toothed tigers every 10 years.
Yeah, like the start of like the agricultural ev revolution, that's what kicked it all off. When they started settling down, paying attention to how things grew, paying attention to the seasons, not just like, oh, it's cold now, I better wear this dead animal's fur. It's like, oh, I know by the stars it's about to get cold, so let's make some jackets for our family. So they started to read the future, and at the same time, that's when religion and spirituality started to manifest. That's my opinion. That's my theory.
Good theory.
It's not as pretty as, you know, God created the world in 7 days, but I have to be real with you. It's a story that I just don't buy. I'll keep it around. I'll read it. I'll let it influence my experience on this planet, but I just don't buy
It's
it.
a
Yeah, it's a hard
hard sell.
sell. Yeah.
But it begs the question, if it's hard to believe that and belief is good, where do you land? How do you choose your own mythology that resonates and
Yeah.
synergizes with your own existence?
Like we've just talked for like 40 minutes about how having trust and belief in some higher power will offer you focus and benefit you in life. But at the same time, I just can't lie to myself, you know? Not saying that your religion is a lie at all for anybody listening at home, but to me, I can't convince myself of it.
You have to listen to that voice inside your head.
Yeah, and he's telling me not to trust any of these people. They're all shysters.
It's funny you say that, because I don't have any difficulty lying to myself. I'm a smoker. It comes naturally. I can easily lie to myself, but the big lies, those ones are harder to swallow. And I just don't know what you do when, like, belief is good.
Here's the thing, you can lie to yourself, but at the same time, I don't think you get to consciously pick and choose what you actually believe or trust. I mean, like if you have like a best friend and they like murder your family, you can't choose to trust that person again. You can't just decide, yeah, I'm gonna believe you and everything you say. I'm gonna trust you. It just doesn't work that way. Like that person has wronged you already. You can't just go against that part of you who feels that pain already and say, yeah, you know what? I trust you and believe you.
I think I could make an argument against that line of thinking, but there's no need to, right? Like, that's a good, healthy boundary. If your best friend kills your family, maybe cut off ties with them.
It's a
But, like,
poor ex it's a poor example, but I just
if they were compelled to, like, maybe you could, because trust is a choice and it takes commitment and it takes reciprocal action, and you gotta be able to feel the room and see if they're willing to be trusted and be trusting. But that is so aside from the notion of agape, right? Like this freeing love of creation that is looking after you and has your best interest at heart and puts on your path those things that will fire you in the lives that create the beautiful gold of existence. And I'd love to think that, some higher power created us all and has our best interests at heart, because that makes forgiving others easier. It makes forgiving yourself easier. But I don't, it's too easy. And
Just
I
because
think
it's easy doesn't mean it's true.
it, like, I'd sooner believe in something that connects us all, get away from the concrete definition of it, but and believe that, at its core, humanity wants to be that agape. It wants to be the parental love and acceptance and hope of all creatures. And I think I also like to believe that love, one small act of love, carries the weight of 10 acts of hate. And I don't know if that's true, but I'd like to believe it. And I'll see if I get to believing it eventually, because
Well,
it certainly makes it easier to do good.
it's one of those things that if you believe in hard enough, it is true. Like, you ever heard the phrase a stitch in time saves nine? Like, it's not true all the time. It's not a mathematical equation that you will save nine stitches if you correct yourself in time. It's just, no, it's you're gonna benefit yourself if you look at things carefully enough to catch your mistakes before they get out of hand. But yeah, at the same time, it's like I really don't think trust and belief is something that you're able to choose. I may be able to be convinced of that later on, but to say I want to believe in God or I want to believe in Zeus or I want to believe in reincarnation, I want to believe in aliens, all seem to be as equally as unfruitful of things to focus on.
Yeah, well, it's afterlife. Maybe not the aliens, but it's like I want to believe in something that gives me the power to do stuff with people on this planet in this lifetime. And I don't want to toil away hoping for reward in the end. Like, I want to be the parent to my own experience. I want to love my blunders and hope to make a friend in the kindergarten of the world.
You're giving a piece of yourself to other people.
What if afterlife doesn't mean what happens after you're done with life? Maybe afterlife is a description of what you focus on after you're done with life. Like after you're done with focusing on all of the specific things in life. Like when your mind starts to wander, okay, I'm done adulting for the day. Now what do I do? Do I play video games or do I go out and hang out with my neighbor? You know, it's what you do in your spare time that
Yeah.
brings you to heaven or to hell.
Well, I was listening to John Vervaeke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, and I forget who he was referencing, but he was talking about this concept of heaven where you didn't die and you didn't run out of energy and you had all of the time in the world and you could complete and master everything. And so, having perpetually existed and mastering all of the things you've ever wanted to master, you finally get to this place where you're asking Saint Peter, like, now what? I can do an 18-hole golf game and get a hole in one on every course. I can create the most beautiful things, but why? Like, what do I do that is fulfilling? And, you know, I was talking about the phrase, like, you know, living your life as though today was your last day. I think you'd do all of the things you impulsively wanted to do, but how would you structure your life if you could do everything you ever dreamed of? Like, if it was given that you would succeed at everything that you put your mind to and that you could master anything, how would you specifically choose to do which things that would fulfill you most?
It sounds a lot like what Alan Watts has to say sometimes. I don't think Vervaeke was referencing Alan Watts, but it does
I don't think
remind
so,
me of
no.
that. Like, what would you do if you could dream any dream you wanted to?
Yeah, like assuming absolute bountiful success in anything that you choose, how do you even choose it?
Yeah. And you could spend all that time, you know, mastering golf or whatever. And Groundhog Day, doesn't he do the same thing?
Well, and it's like Odysseus did the same thing, right? Like he chose to return home, and he did it, and he knew he would do it. And maybe he didn't know he would do it, but he knew that he was going to do it no matter what, and that's what he did. And he got home and he cleaned up his house and he got his affairs in order and he chose the life that he chose, and he presumably went on to live it and very happily ever after. So what choice are you going to make today for the rest
I
of your
think
life?
going deep into this rabbit hole with this of a conversation, I think it's all about just cleaning up yourself, getting rid of all the mud out of your system and trying to sparkle, for lack of a better word.
And then what?
And then
Once you're
what?
completely perfect.
Treasure your relationships. Be kind to others. Experience Christian love in all things you do. Agape. Is that the
I don't know, I haven't
right
gotten
answer,
there.
Will? Live to tell the tale. How did you clean up your act so that you can
Hmm.
inspire others?
Like the cave. Your job is to escape the cave. Learn all you can and then come back into the cave. Because that's the most important part of the cave, is to return and actually learn to articulate all the things that you bring back to them. Bring them some of the light.
I think that's a good note to end on. Also, we didn't say it before, but welcome back to Book Club. I'm Will. That's Scott and Pat.
Hi.
If
And
you
if
like
you're,
this, you can check us out.
yeah, we got a website, bookwave.club. We got our podcast on anchor.fm, Spotify, Apple iTunes, and all the other good things. We got a comment section on YouTube you can check out. We got a blog postings sometimes on our website you can comment on. You can shoot us a message if you want to, you know, join us for a conversation sometime. You know, we're
Or
always.
what did you think about the books we've read?
If you have anything that you thought we missed from the Odyssey that was really important that you wanted to see a conversation about, well, let us know in the comments and maybe we'll do a part two. Because this text is quite extensive and I'm sure we could do another one on it if we really wanted to. Include some of the Iliad again, since we've read both. But yeah, it's been really crazy to just build this frame, like we say, of all of these books that we've been reading, adding to that outlook on life and this worldview.
Yeah, especially this one. I've definitely gotten some really good things out of this, so.
Yeah, lots of story ideas for me too. So that's a good plus. But until next time, may the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.